This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From Dracon Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everybody. I'm Jeremy Scott. Hopefully, you and yours had a happy Thanksgiving. Got a lot to cover this week. We've had a lot of news come over the past couple of weeks. Charlie's going to be with me here in just a little bit to go over that. But after that, we're going to have USF 2000 champion Christian Rasmussen on. He's back home in Denmark, and we're going to talk about what he's been doing and how he's been preparing to get ready for next season, who he's been talking to for his ride in Indy Pro 2000. And then after that, Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network anchor Mark Janes joins us, and we're going to be dissecting the 2020 NTT IndyCar Series season. So some good news, we have a Facebook page finally, no longer a Facebook group, Inside Open Wheel, so the best way to find it, at Inside Open Wheel on Twitter, and Google Voice, so you can leave us a voice message, 815-714-9260. All right, Charlie, you sent me something not too long ago to our email, insideopenwheel@gmail.com. Some big news coming out of the world of iRacing.
excuse me, yeah. So they're introducing the Dallara IR01, which you are forgiven if you've never heard of it, because it's actually not a real car. What I gather from the press release and from the video is that iRacing basically partnered up with Dallara, and they went through the same process that a series would go through to create a car. So, for example, if we created Inside Open Wheel, the racing series, we would go to Dallara and say, hey, we want you to build a car for us. This is what we wanted to do. And this is what we wanted to race like. And then they would take those and create something. So it looks like iRacing went to them and said, hey, can you create a car for a top level open wheel series? And they did it. And it basically is a semi-fictional car. They sort of imply in the press release that they're going to build the real one, but they designed it first in iRacing, and it's coming out next week.
It looks gorgeous from what I've seen in the pictures and the video, but there's something else I want to highlight. If you look at the pictures, Charlie, what track is that that's there in the background?
Oh, that's Long Beach.
Yes. So
yep. Oh, that's. I guess you haven't been paying attention to, or maybe you have.
I have
paying attention to. I have. What's going on? So I don't know how familiar you are or the listeners are with iRacing, but they work on a quarterly season schedule. So if you're the public races in iRacing, they have 12-week schedules. So every week is a new circuit for each championship that they support. And then so at the end of 12 weeks, there's a 1 week grace period, which is known as week 13, where they roll out all the new content for the service going forward. And they're very, very good at keeping things under wraps until the week or two before they are released. So right now we're in week 12. And so now we're getting all of the announcements of the stuff that we're going to be getting next week. So Long Beach, this new car from semi-fictional car from Dallara. They're also introducing the Coca-Cola International Speedway, which is a fictional track from NASCAR Racing 2003, which is sort of the grandfather of iRacing. And it's a massive, like 2.5 mile speedway, and there's no restrictor plates. So I don't know if they're going to be, that was the idea in NASCAR 2003, is what would a race be like in NASCAR without restrictor plates. So I assume that that's going to apply to NASCAR or to iRacing as well, but I'm not entirely sure. But so that's why we're getting all this stuff. So Long Beach has been part of the service as a sort of like unfinished circuit for a while. And the official reason was that because if they put in all the buildings, it would sort of bog down performance, and you would need a really high-end computer to run it. I guess they've figured out a way to get around that now, so they're finally releasing the full version.
That's pretty cool. They finally were able to do it, because Long Beach has been one of my favorite street circuits. It's one of the ones that I've not been to yet, so it's on a bucket list. Maybe I should finally get some iRacing. Maybe I should start a GoFundMe to get a gaming computer, so that way I can actually play iRacing and all that. So.
It's a great time to jump in. I mean, this year has been huge for iRacing. I mean, not just the fact that it got a lot of attention during the lockdown, but the content that they've been releasing this year has been awesome.
Yeah, it looks like it's been awesome, especially since, you know, a lot of the pro racers have been using it to kind of keep their skills sharp, especially in the extended off season. And, you know, you had the iRacing championships for IndyCar, NASCAR. I think IMSA may have had one. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the F4 FRA was on iRacing, but the FRP, was that one on R-Factor, or was that on iRacing?
The FRP was on iRacing. We were using the Skip Barber car.
Okay. All right, so I think it was the other way around. So, yeah, it's going to be a great time to get on iRacing if you can. Hopefully we can ride their coattails eventually as well. Speaking of interesting developments, a couple of people pointed out, you as well, that Jimmy Johnson this week has been shaking. I first heard about this from Twitter. He was on Fox and Friends and saying, yeah, I've been, you know, driving some lower formula cars. Okay. Turns out that he was in Barber with a whole bunch of teams running Hunter Yaney's FRA with VRD, spent a couple days down there, and as he's put it on Twitter, trying to lose what he learned in NASCAR. So, at first I thought that Jimmy Johnson, okay, you know, this is cool, you know, gets a name in there, you know, get a couple races to get used to, driving an open wheel lighter car. Okay, I'm fine with that. You know, whatever. He's not going to be up at the front. But the fact he's taking time learning these racetracks and relearning how to run a road course in a, you know, a lower horsepower car, but something that's close to power to weight ratio that he's going to see in IndyCar, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of shows the kind of work ethic that you sort of develop as second nature when you're, what, 7-time NASCAR champion?
Yep.
The driving style between a NASCAR stock car and an Indy car or any open wheel car is very different, obviously. First of all, you have the engine in the back. You don't have, like, you have less than half the weight, maybe a third of it. And you have the massive amounts of downforce. So it's a completely different driving style. And like you said, he's going to have to unlearn a lot of the things that are probably ingrained very deeply into his brain from running NASCAR for what, 20 years or
yeah,
so?
Yeah, 20 years sounds about right.
So it makes a lot of sense that, like, he's sort of doing an abbreviated, you know, kids come up the ladder and they learn these things, and he's sort of starting at the top, but taking the off season to kind of learn the lessons that the kids learn at the sort of early stages of their career.
And it gives him a chance to run with something that kind of is up and around him that he's going to see in IndyCar. Now, granted, you may think, okay, the halo is totally different from the windscreen, but if you take that windscreen off, you essentially have a halo, because that's what that is.
Yeah, I think the halo is probably one of the lesser challenges.
Yeah.
I think you kind of learn to ignore that very quickly. Probably like halfway through the warm-up lap, he's going to forget that it's there. I think jumping into one of the lower cars, I think, is also very smart, because, how many times do you hear driver coaches say, you know, start in a lower horsepower car, it sort of shows your mistakes. You can't use horsepower to get yourself out of a mistake. So going into an F3 car, it's got the downforce that he's going to need to learn. It's got the pace and the speed, but it doesn't have quite as much horse or nearly as much horsepower as an Indy car. So if he makes a mistake, it's going to show up on the data. His coaches are going to be able to point to that. He's going to be able to sort of log that in his brain and learn, you know, obviously very quickly, since he's a very good driver, how to improve when he goes back into an Indy car.
Well, it doesn't hurt that he's going to have a great coach on the pit box, Tony Kanaan. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how he does in his first couple races next year.
Yeah, and he gets right in the fire with a street course at St. Petersburg. Something the closest he's ever done is the Roval at almost like Kansas, the Roval at Charlotte.
Yeah, and I, from my limited experience in iRacing, that's actually a pretty good, it feels a lot like a street circuit.
Yeah.
The walls are very close. There's not a whole lot of runoff. I think he'll get right into it.
So we'll keep an eye on that. Also, something that came up at Barber was Turn 3 Motorsport. Our buddy Peter Dempsey, who owns that team, looks like they're going to be dipping their toe into the USF 2000 water as they tested two drivers in what looked to be new to them USF 2000 Tatuses.
Yeah, it looks like they haven't had time to repaint those cars, or maybe they're just kind of leasing them for this test. It'll be interesting to see. I have to talk to Peter and see what's going to be going on with my car next year. Hopefully he runs it again. I think they did a very good job with it this year, and I'm excited to see what they'll hopefully do with it next year.
Well, you had Daniel Frost in the car, so I mean, it's not a surprise.
Yeah, hopefully they get another good driver next year, and the car is obviously capable of running up at the front. Both of their cars are. So
yeah,
if any young drivers are listening to this and they're looking for a team to race with in Pro 2000 next year, give Peter a call.
Yeah, well, and if you can't get a hold of Peter, one of us will gladly get in touch, because both of us know Peter, obviously, from you dealing with the cars and me dealing with the junior formulas. So you had Turn 3 there. You had VRD. I think a couple other teams were testing at Barber. So an interesting mix of cars on the track and a varying mix of talents. But seeing the Jimmy Johnson news, I'm sorry, that made me about as giddy as a kid at Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a smart approach, I think.
All right, coming up next on Inside Open Wheel, Charlie and I dissect what exactly happened at Bahrain. Yes, we're going to talk about that incident, because both of us have experience with safety and walls.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Charlie and I continue with news and notes. Before we get into the Bahrain Armco discussion, we were supposed to have some news from Formula Race Promotions. Yesterday on their Twitter page, we retweeted it. They said they have some big news. Well, their schedule's out. It's full. They confirmed over the Thanksgiving week that Mid-Ohio is going to be on the date that they said it would. They have three new tracks. I'm sure all their series are set. So now we're going to wait until next week to find out what the big news is. We will have that first on our Facebook page, Twitter. We might even, if it's big enough, we might even do a breaking news story. But I hope, maybe it's just me being in the media world, but seeing the success of fanracing.live, seeing the success of the live broadcast for the Road to Indy, FRP needs to take a step in those pages, figure out how to do streaming cheaply, because these kids who are running, I'm sorry, the F1600 series, some of the best racing in the country right now. We've seen some pretty close finishes this year.
Yeah, I think the FRP series is sort of in an interesting place on the ladder, because it's kind of, I tell people that it's blending club racing with pro racing, because at the front of the field in F1600, you have pro teams, you have pro drivers that are just starting out in their careers. And then at the back of the grid, you have these sort of experienced club racers that want something more competitive than like the four or five car fields you might find at a regional, but they don't necessarily have or want to spend the money like on a full-on pro program. And then there's people like me that are kind of stuck right in the middle of that. So I guess they have to kind of decide what they want to do. If FRP wants to be a pro series, like a bottom of the ladder pro series, or if they want to be kind of a top of the ladder club series, because I mean, if you pick one side or the other, like for a top of the ladder club series, it might not make sense to put the effort and the expense into streaming or right. the media stuff that goes along with pro racing. But if you want to be a sort of bottom of the ladder pro series, then it does make sense to do that. And it's worth the effort, it's worth the expense, and it's worth the increased budgets that it would take for the teams and the drivers to get involved in that stuff.
And Charlie, you're one of the very few people who know what I'm about to say, but because you and I have actually discussed this, we've discussed doing something to promote this if they do want to be a bottom of the rung pro series, which honestly there's nothing wrong about that because we don't have a professional 1600 championship in this country, period. Past couple of years I've been trying to get with Formula Race Promotions to do even if it's radio, audio streaming. It's a start because you have drivers like a Jackson Lee, a Simon Sykes, a Dylan, a Dylan Christie who are coming up. They want to make their next move, whether it's into F4 or into USF 2000, they want to, make their first move. Well, they need to be, out front and center. They need to have their name out there. So, not only can these team owners know, but these sponsors say, hey, you know what? We're getting our product out there because our driver's up at the front and being mentioned with the product. Like I said, granted, it's just, audio streaming, but at the same time, it's better than a press release that, five or six people care about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the advantages of being in the position that they're in sort of towards the bottom is that they don't have any media agreements in place. Like, I don't know if we talked about it off air or on air in the last podcast or in the past, but one of the problems with IndyCar is that they have this dependence on NBC and on these broadcast networks. And so a lot of the things that might make sense from a consumer's perspective, like live streaming, like supplemental post-race coverage, like that sort of pushes the viewer off of their TV platform and onto something like YouTube or Twitch, NBC is not going to want to do that. But the FRP series could just say, hey, we're going to broadcast on Twitch. We're going to have a post-race show on YouTube that's live streamed. They can do all that. The only thing that's keeping them from doing it is the cost of it.
So we'll see what happens. We'll definitely pay attention. I don't want it to be like, what I said about, five or six people caring about it. I'm talking about, myself, some of the other bloggers who do, like FormulaScout.com, F1 Feeder Series, those who follow these series regularly. So we will find out about that next week. We got a big show next week. We'll preview that at the end of the show. All right. So it's time for the rant that really has been a week in the making. And I tried to get some information on what happened, but we'll talk about that through the rant. Obviously, we know the story. First lap of the Bahrain Grand Prix, Romain Grosjean tries to avoid Kimi Raikkonen, who went off driver's left, tried to come back on. From the many views I've seen, he went right to give Kimi room, but it looks like he also hit some debris, which took out part of that right front suspension. At that point, the contact with Daniel Kvyat, that was just, double-edged sword right there. I can't remember how fast it was, but it was a pretty significant impact that Romain Grosjean made with the guardrail. The car split in half. The driver compartment went through. Big fireball, and like I told you, Charlie, off the air, it reminded me a lot of the 1964 Indianapolis 500 crash with Dave McDonald and Eddie Sachs.
I have a historical reference for it too. It actually was very, very similar to the crash that killed Francois Sever.
Yes, that was another one.
73?
That was another one I thought of too.
Yeah, I remember reading Jackie Stewart's account of it because he jumped in his car and drove up there to see if he could help out. And he said that the car was exactly as Grosjean's was. It was wedged in into the Armco. So it's a sobering reminder that the dangers that existed back then still exist now. And that, we should be thankful for all of the safety improvements.
Well, if I remember
we've seen in the last, I can't even do the quick math.
40 years.
50 years.
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, the difference between Cervé's crash and Grosjean's crash was
Sever.
The Armco on at Watkins Glen, it was the center one that didn't move, whereas in Bahrain, the top one didn't move.
Hmm.
So I think that's because I did some more research on that over the past week. So I tried to talk to one of my sources who is in the know with the FIA to kind of get his explanation on why there was a guardrail there at that point. Granted, it was on a straightaway. However, this is 2020. There should not be guardrail at a racetrack. And I know I'm saying this as the track announcer of a track that is exclusively guardrail. I understand that. But we've come to the point in safety where there are other options to put walls around a racetrack. Tech Pro, look at how well that is. Let's take a look at, where was it? Was it Sochi with Carlos Sainz when he was with Renault, where he went straight off and hit that? Yeah, he was injured, but you know what? We didn't have a car break apart. We didn't have a fire for, you know, as well, because they were gapped out. Guardrail's bad news, period.
It looks very flimsy, doesn't it? It's basically just like corrugated steel, like thick corrugated steel that's backed every so often by a post. And yeah, I mean, if a car going into it at a certain speed is going to rip it up, no problem.
And yeah, I mean, I have seen cars on top of guardrails before. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry. It's 2020. It's just time that we have we're past the point of having guardrails, because we're damn lucky that Romain Grosjean is still with us. Thank goodness. And that halo, and you know, I'll admit I was one of the people who didn't like the halo. I didn't like the look of it. I thought, well, we could do something better. You know what? The halo saved his life. The halo kept him from hitting his head on the guardrail.
Yeah, I don't think anybody can really debate that anymore.
Also, I think F1 needs to take a hard look at their refueling rules, because that's why the huge fireball happened, is because it was packed with all that fuel.
Yeah, well, I guess when you introduce refueling, then you get into the problems in the pit lane. So it's, you know, it's going to be a danger no matter what. I think the problem, because the fuel tank is embedded into the monocoque.
Yes.
That's across all, like, that's a standard configuration for all Formula cars today. I think what happened, and this is just sort of based on a little bit of the public information, is that I would assume that when the engine ripped off, when the back half of the car ripped off of the monocoque, it ripped open some fuel lines. And so that's, you know, how the fireball got so big is a question, but I don't like, if the engine rips off of the car, how are you, like, fuel's going to get out no matter what. Right. I guess just the question is, how do you limit it?
And it's but the problem is too, it's a matter of how much fuel comes out. You know, would you rather have 150 liters, 75 liters? You know, are we getting to the point now where, okay, we need to make these engines more fuel efficient? Okay. Well then at that point, when do we lose the sporting aspect of everything? So,
yeah, that's, you know, I guess that's a discussion for someone with more expertise than me. But how did so much fuel get out of the car so quickly?
Yeah.
This is the question.
And let's also say this, that those cars are designed to break apart in something like that. So
yeah,
that's the good news.
The engine ripping off of the car is actually based pretty much standard for big accidents in open wheel cars.
Yep.
And it's, you know, the engine flying away on its own is the car dissipating energy that's not being absorbed by the driver. So it's a good thing, as long as it doesn't tumble into someone else. But so we shouldn't be too concerned about that. But how do we minimize the damage from the inevitable fuel that's going to be spilling out?
And if you follow me on social media, you know that I've had my grievances with race director Michael Massey of Formula One. But the one thing that he did right, because they are in sand, was, you know, we'll put the concrete walls there and we'll worry about later. I mean, they should have put tires there too, but, you know, I'm happy with the temporary situation. Looks like that's what they did for this weekend, is put tires in front of that impact area, because if one car got there, you sure as hell know that another one's going to make it there too.
Yeah, I mean, you can't plan for all eventualities, but yeah, I mean, at this point, I mean, yeah, you gotta look at how to replace the Armcos, because there's better ways to do it at this point.
You know, and Grant, I know that not every track is a Formula One track. I understand, but there's got to be a point where Armco it's just got to be eliminated. Period. It's good,
yeah, especially at the top rated FIA certified tracks. They need a better system,
and I think that's where I have. That's what I had the problem with. The second I saw, you know, the car went through the guardrail, it's like, okay, that's it. You know, I've always been, let's start looking at other options for, you know, the Armco, you know, but now I'm to the point where not just Formula One cars, but you have other cars that are getting faster. They're getting lighter. So, you know, impacts are going to be greater when it comes to that. And if you have Armco there, yeah, a car's going to go there. So, maybe there needs to be a serious point in the next couple of years where safety officials go, okay, this is what we have to do. We need to put these in place by this, this, and this, and we need to figure out how to get that across all tracks, because not all tracks can afford it, but there's got to be a system to where there's a central governing body that says we need to improve on safety and assist other tracks that, you know, don't have the funding to make that, you know, like, you know, your smaller independent tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, at the very least, the Formula One tracks need to be.
Yeah.
Because they do have the money. They can afford it.
Yep. Yep. Well, they've got to replace. They got to put standard in lights because, you know, thanks to the FIM and FIA, which I do applaud that, you know, especially with something that high ranking, you are going to need lights. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's the end of the rant. Coming up next is Christian Rasmussen, the J. Howard driver, development driver, who won the USF 2000 title, looking to go into Indy Pro 2000 next season.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, as you heard, our big road to Indy Spectacular is going to be next week. We can thank the affable Canadian that goes to Canada and doesn't stay here in the States, Rob Howden, for that one. But couldn't pass up an opportunity to sit down with our USF 2000 champion, Christian Rasmussen. He's back home, so Christian, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us. I guess it's been a whirlwind past couple months for you since you won the title at New Jersey Motorsports Park.
No, yeah, for sure. It's been great. It's been a great experience. Finally taking the championship. I've been back home for the last month or so, and been trying to get into a good routine of working out and doing all the stuff that I'm supposed to do to get ready for the next season.
Working out, staying away from the Christmas goodies. I get that. I'm getting to that point now that we've ended Thanksgiving here in the States. We'll go from one suite to the next. But nonetheless, let's talk about your season with J. Howard Driver Development. It was a pretty dominating start to the season for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a really great start of the season. Won the straight first six straight races. Then we had a couple of tough race weekends. We had Indianapolis and the Mid Ohio afterwards, which weren't the best of weekends with the results. But then we came back at the last race at Mid Ohio, won there, and finished it up at New Jersey. So yeah, great season for me. Very happy with my own performance and the team's performance, and it just really, everything just really came together this year.
Well, and it helps to have such, you know, you have a good driver coach in J. Howard. You have great team. You had great teammates last year, so put all that together, and it was almost like a no-brainer that you're going to challenge for the championship.
For sure, for sure. We knew that we were coming off a momentum of of the 2019 season, I was the driver with the most points in the second half. So we knew that we were gonna try to compete for the championship, and that's what we did, and it worked out. So that was great.
All right, so you normally I'll save it for the end, but let's go ahead and talk about next season. We know what the schedule looks like for Indy Pro 2000. Have you talked to any of the teams, or are you going to try and get Jay to move up to IP 2000 for next year?
We're definitely talking with a lot of teams. We haven't signed a contract for next season yet, but we're definitely getting closer to making that decision, and hopefully you guys will hear about that soon.
Now, did you get a chance to sit in a Pro 2000 car before you came home?
I have not been in the Pro 2000 car yet, no.
So what are you doing iRacing then to kind of get used to what the car is going to at least look like at speed?
I mean, for me, I think the physical side of things is the most important. I think that's where I can make the most benefit for myself, staying fit and prepare myself for the best shape that I can be in to start the season. Obviously, it's gonna be tough whenever you start driving a faster car on the neck and all the muscles. That's very hard to train in the gym and stuff. But that's where my main focus is for sure.
Well, it's gotta help though that you're going from the same chassis, basically just a little bit different package. Going from one step to the next.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's going to be very similar, and that's what I hope. And we'll see. I mean, I'm sure I'll figure it out at some point.
Christian Rasmussen joins us here on Inside Open Wheel, the USF 2000 champion for 2020. And I've got to ask, what is your workout regimen when you get home?
Well, I mean, I really much try to work out every day,
right.
and that's what I do. I don't have a specific program that I follow, but I have been working out for myself for a lot of years now. So I kind of know my way around the gym. I know what exercises work. I know what exercises will help me when I sit in a car. So I try to do as much as I can with balanced training and of course also a lot of cardio and strength training. I just try to get a good variety of everything just to get myself best possibly prepared.
It's just a matter of making sure that you're set up for the additional G-forces that you're going to see. Not only that, but starting to really think about oval racing if you're going to move up the ladder for IndyCar. You know, what's that like knowing that you're going to be in a higher horsepower car to, you know, run the only oval of the season?
No, it's going to be exciting. I really started to like the ovals. I really fell in love with Lucas Oil Raceway the first time I drove it in 2019. I think a lot of European drivers look at the ovals and maybe don't find them as interesting as a lot of other stuff. But I also think that is the lack of actually trying it that gives them that opinion. I was definitely very, very surprised by how fun and how cool the racing was there. And then to take the win at Lucas Oil Raceway this year, only my second year on an oval, was great. I'm just looking forward to get into the new car, even a faster car, and also putting on another oval on the resume.
Well, and also, you know, the European drivers, they see the highlights, they see the crashes, they think, oh, no, that I don't want to be a part of that. Those are big crashes, but yeah. Sometimes looks can be deceiving with those crashes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, IndyCar and the whole safety around the ovals and around racing in general has just been improving so much the last couple of years. They're always trying to improve and just to make it as safe as possible for us drivers. So we can't say that bad things can't happen, because it can. We are in racing. It is a dangerous sport, but it's definitely come a long way. And that's just, yeah, that's the good pop.
And you add an oval in Worldwide Technology Raceway in Madison, Illinois. So you go from the little bull ring at Lucas Oil Raceway to what would be considered a little bit bigger bull ring in an egg-shaped race course. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. That's one of the better races of the year, oval-wise, for IndyCar especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be very exciting. I'm definitely looking forward to it. We had a great run at Lucas Oil this year, and hopefully we can continue that onto next year at Lucas Oil as well as Worldwide Technology Raceway.
So outside of working out and preparing for next season, what is what's one of your favorite things to do when you're at home with your family, with your friends that you grew up around?
I enjoy just being together, seeing my friends and family. Obviously we have to restrict that a little bit in these times of my family, a bit of a break from all the racing, so we can just recharge and be ready for the season.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of nice to get that break, get away from racing, get away from the motorsports, the hustle and bustle. And I'm sure for you also, you're coming back home to what you're used to. You spent a couple of years here in the States, but you go back home and it's like, okay, I can relax. I don't have to stress out too much. Yeah, I should work out, but I'm not under pressure to do this, and this.
Yeah, exactly. But then again, I have a lot of stuff going on. We are negotiating with different teams, and that takes a lot of time. Yep. And I have some other projects at home that definitely also takes up some time. So being a race car driver in 2020 is a full-time job, even in the off season. So I'm definitely spending my time doing a lot of different stuff, and I'm looking forward to start racing again.
Yeah, let's talk about that social media. In the off season, how tied to your phone are you? Giving people updates, communicating with your fans, and different series, tweets or messages that you see from the different series.
No, we're definitely trying to stay engaged with everyone. Trying to do the best we can, but it's also doing. Obviously, we have had a lot of interest in me with me winning the championship. Also, not only from U.S. media, but also Danish media, national television, all kinds of different newspapers have wanting to get interviews, and that has definitely also taken up some time, and I've been enjoying doing that as well.
As I say, how's the press coverage been back home since you won your title?
It's been great. I've been in Danish national television and will be again here in a week's time. A lot of different newspapers, big nationwide newspapers in Denmark that has been writing great articles about my winnings in 2020, and yeah, it's amazing to see what a championship can do even when I am driving on and almost the other side of the world. Then still the Danish media is still interested and still wants to follow it.
So can you ask your fellow Dane Kevin Magnussen to come over or play in IndyCar? I know rumors are he's going to IMSA, but come have him come to IndyCar. I think that would be great for your career too.
I think it would. I'll let him know my thoughts on that.
All right, so how can people follow you on social media and find out about when you've signed with the team?
You guys can follow me on Christian_Rasmussen_ on my Instagram, Christian Rasmussen Racing on my Facebook, and Christian_DK on Twitter.
Christian, good luck. Have a Merry Christmas, and we'll chat with you here in a while.
We will definitely talk soon. Merry Christmas.
Coming up on Inside Open Wheel, Nick Yeoman and other company will be joining us for our IndyCar review. Stay tuned.
This is Inside Open Wheel, Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, it's that time of the show where we wrap up the 2020 NTT IndyCar Series season, and who better to do it than the man who saw every lap, every turn of the season? It is Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network's Mark Janes. And Mark, this is we keep saying this, it's a season unlike any other, but I can't remember a season where we were going in completely blind because we didn't know anything about testing. We knew who was going to be where, but how is that going to affect things? You know, some people are going to different places, you know, one driver in two different teams at once. It was a stranger offseason than we've seen, to say the least.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it kind of started out that way. You know, COVID had started to rear its ugly head a bit into February and March. And, you know, I mean, Nick Yeoman and I got off the plane together at St. Petersburg, and we got to their green flag luncheon, which they host every year with the St. Pete Chamber. And about the time we sat down, there were some rumblings that the announcement was going to be made later that day that there weren't going to be any fans allowed at the event. And then, you know, they did make that announcement later that day, in fact. And so on Friday, I didn't even go to the track because we had one Indy Lights practice session scheduled, and they were being at that point pretty restrictive about who was to come in and out. And so my mother lives nearby St. Pete, and I was on my way to see her after the lights session wrapped up. And, you know, I get a call from our network director saying, hey, you might want to get back to the hotel. They're going to shut it down, and you may have to go back on a charter tonight. I mean, I ended up going back the next day, but you know, once the NBA pulled the plug on their season, and then NASCAR followed shortly thereafter, I think the optics of it alone necessitated IndyCar doing what they did. And then, you know, within 24 to 36 hours, a good portion of the first quarter of the season was scrapped. And at that point, we didn't know when or if we would see a wheel turn in 2020. Unfortunately, that ended up not being the case. Sadly, there were some venues that we didn't get to go to, which are really cool venues. It looked as though that all of this, you know, is costing us certainly a return trip to Iowa and not being able to go back to Richmond. But outside of that, I think it was somewhat fortuitous that Penske Entertainment bought the series and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, because I think with the resources that they had available to them, just the staff alone, you know, keeping Mark Miles and Jay Fry in the fold, between, you know, all of those gentlemen and Roger and Bud Denker and everyone associated with the Penske Group, and combining their efforts with Jay and Mark and everyone else in IndyCar, I think they're to be commended for the fact that they were able to get, I think, a very entertaining competitive season put together on the fly.
Yeah, and it was neat to see the series start their season in Texas, a mainstay of IndyCar, per se, since the IRL was founded outside of Indianapolis. But huge kudos has to go to Eddie Gossage for taking the risk of not having fans, but still having the product on scene. And it's something that Anders has even said, you know, about practice. We didn't have any practice, just hardly any practice, to get out there and run.
Yeah, I mean, NASCAR, I think, did that all season long. No practice, no qualifying. And, you know, I don't know that that's ideal. I think a nice compromise is one practice session, maybe two at the most, or a practice session and a warm-up, and then you go qualifying. And, you know, now that I think we've found a way to make that, you know, compelling and make it work, I don't know that you'll see moving forward too many shows dragged out over 3 or 4 days unnecessarily. I mean, you know, depending on how many series that you'll see, how many different classes of cars, if I can use that short track term, at a venue over a race weekend, I think at the most you would see a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. In fact, I think that's what St. Pete is scheduled to be now. But I think moving forward, you're going to see more and more, you know, one or two practice sessions on Saturday, maybe one practice session, then qualifying, and then you go racing on Sunday, and you may get a warm-up session here and there. And I think it makes economical sense for the teams. Puts a lot of pressure on those drivers to make sure that they keep that equipment together, for sure. But I think there are going to be some things that we stumbled upon during this pandemic in terms of scheduling, especially over the course of a race weekend. Those are things that I don't think will go away anytime soon.
Well, we started the season off with shuffling seats. Marcus Ericsson went to Chip Ganassi Racing. James Hinchcliffe also was relieved of his duties to Air McLaren SP. They signed Oliver Askew and Padua Ward. Spencer Pigot wouldn't be returning in 2020, so Renus VK was in the 21 seat. We'll talk more about that signing. Bourdais was out at Dale Coyne Racing, Vassar Sullivan. You had Santino Ferrucci taking in the 18th seat. Connor Daly signed with Ed Carpenter Racing for the street courses. On and on. This was one of those seasons, off seasons, where there was just a lot of movement, and you spent those for a couple months thinking, okay, I got to remember this driver's here, this driver's not going to be racing, this driver's in this seat. A lot of musical chairs went on this past off season.
Yeah, I think, we got to St. Pete, and usually that's the time when during those two or three practice sessions that you can acclimate yourself to cars and drivers. But, we didn't get the opportunity to do that. And it felt like in some respects that, we were playing catch up with, trying to keep track of who was driving where and when. I don't think anybody was more challenged with that this year than Connor Daly was, for sure. And I think he did a masterful job, for both Ed Carpenter and certainly for Carlin. It's a reminder that it is indeed a business. And, we have the benefit of Davey Hamilton as our driver analyst. And Davey, of course, a two-time series runner-up and, has driven for a lot of drivers over the years. He's been a race promoter. He owns race teams. Davey has been on the business side of it. And, to the general public or even to those that are quote unquote inside the sport from a standpoint of covering it all the time, some decisions, when they're made, why they're made and how they're made, certainly don't make a lot of sense, but that's because sometimes the business side of it doesn't make a lot of sense. And that's what it boils down to as much as anything. I think this off season was obviously most difficult for the road to Indy because, typically we crown an Indy Lights champion that moves on to the NTT IndyCar Series. So I guess in that regard, for most of the drivers that were in the NTT IndyCar Series this year, there weren't the worries that they had in previous years about somebody showing up with that, that $1 million check and having a chance to take a ride even on a part-time basis. So, I think the paddock obviously is going to look very, very familiar next year in terms of the names, but even next year you're going to see some shuffling of drivers for sure.
And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. First four races at three tracks, Texas, IndyGP, Road America, all Chip Ganassi. Scott Dixon taking the first three. Felix Rosenquist finally breaking through in that second Road America race in a battle with Padua Ward. And the one thing that stuck out to me was that final pit stop. Davey, being the former strategist he was as well, seeing what the five team did to Padua Ward and said, yeah, those tires aren't going to last. And at a place like Road America, you have to have those fresh tires to stay in front because they go away quick.
Yeah, sometimes guys have a tendency, we've seen it over the years, to outthink themselves a little bit. And I asked Davey about it right away because when he saw those tires going on the car, on the monitor, I mean, I could tell by his body language and his expression that he was not in agreement with that call. And of course I had to ask him about it because he's shaking his head no and giving it the thumbs down. And then, we asked him about it on the air and it ended up being spot on as he is 99.9% of the time. And, sometimes those race strategists and those engineers have a tendency to roll the dice. I think, most notably, we typically see it in qualifying, I think, don't we, where a guy is, mm-hmm. Maybe within a couple of tenths here and, maybe he's not going to have a pole run, but he could maybe have a top five or a top six start. And then they get into qualifying and they end up starting 18th or 19th. And then we talked to him post-qualifying and they said, well, we made an attempt. We were looking for a tenth here or a tenth there or maybe a little less than that. We threw something at the car and it was the wrong thing, but we'll be okay because we'll put the old setup back on it and then we'll go. And I think that's the difficult call oftentimes, and that's why, as they say, the old adage is they get paid the big bucks. So, you know, it ended up for sure not being the right call. But I will say that I'm sure as frustrated as that entire race team was, they certainly had full confidence in themselves and their decision making moving forward.
Let's talk about real quick too, Scott Dixon taking those first three races, one at Texas, one at the Indy GP, the other at the first Road America race. The man didn't need testing. He's got to be on the Mount Rushmore of IndyCar drivers as it stands right now, because you put him in any situation, he will get that car to the front.
Well, and I think that's always been the key to Scott. I mean, even those years over the years where maybe he didn't have the car to win and he was in the battle for a championship, you know, he was smart enough to bring home a top four, a top five, maybe a top six and pile up some points. I mean, I think in terms of the laps that the races that he started, I think only 17% of the time over the years, going back to 2000, 2001, I think only 17% of the time he's had a DNF over that period of time. And that I think is the most impressive statistic of all. It is a bit surprising that he's only won one Indianapolis 500, but when you consider the number of drivers that have qualified for the 500 over the years, that's still a monumental accomplishment. And I'm sure that in the back of his mind that weighs on him a little bit, especially because as he gets older, not suggesting he's anywhere past his prime as he has proven this year, but I think he'd at least like to get there one more time, as they all would that have won it once. But certainly with every race that he leads and every race that he wins, he continues to settle in among the all-time greats and has leapfrogged over some of the all-time greats over the past couple of years, and rightfully so. And I think that, you know, we'll look fondly back upon this period of time that we had the chance to see him when he was at his best. And I think another thing that I don't think is discussed enough is his lengthy association with Chip Ganassi Racing. I mean, you know, teams and drivers just don't stay together that long anymore. Personnel changes, people change, and you know, it hampers the success that they have on track. I mean, look no further than the guy who comes to Ganassi Racing next year. I mean, Jimmy Johnson has not been the Jimmy Johnson that we've seen when, you know, all those cup championships over the past couple of years. And, you know, that all kind of started to fall by the wayside when Chad Knaus left his pit box. For Scott to be able to not only, you know, maintain his competitive edge with Ganassi, but continue to be surrounded by the guys that have played such a big role in all of his championships and all of his wins, I think is a rarity in any form of sports nowadays.
Before we cut to break, I do want to talk about Jimmy Johnson first. Earlier in the show, Charlie and I talked about how he went out in a Formula Regional Americas, basically an F3 car, and spent a couple days at Barber Motorsports Park. As somebody who's been in IndyCar as long as you have, what does that say to you, to somebody who, you know, okay, yeah, I want to do IndyCar, compared to I want to do well in IndyCar, so I'm going to, you know, spend my offseason training with this?
Well, I think, you know, he too, I mean, is one of those that has to be considered one of the greatest of all time. Now, not in the category of a multi-talented discipline like a Tony Stewart or an A.J. Foyt or a Montoya or certainly Mario Andretti. But certainly in NASCAR, he is among the all time greats, and rightfully so. I think that it won't be an easy time for him coming to the NTT IndyCar series because of how difficult these cars can be to drive. But I will say that if for whatever the reason he's not competitive, right out of the box, it won't be because he hasn't done his homework, because the second half of the season, especially anytime he had the opportunity to spend some time with that team or at that track or the simulator, whatever the case may be. I mean, you know, Chip talked about, you know, and Mike Hull talked about showing up at St. Pete, and, you know, Jimmy had been there for a half an hour prior to when they got there that morning before he left to run the cup race that weekend. I think he becomes certainly, you know, if not the most, one of the most recognizable drivers in the series, which I think is huge. I think it will pull some of the naysayers, the fans from NASCAR that don't have much interest in IndyCar for whatever the reason. I think it's going to bring eyes to it. And I hope for that reason that he is competitive. Do I think he's going to win three, four, five races? Do I think he's going to rack up a ton of podium finishes? No, I don't. I do think that he's going to be really competitive, though, because he's just that good, and he's going to put in the time and the energy and the effort he needs to start out respectable. And I'm sure he'll have a goal sheet in mind each and every race weekend. And who knows? That's the thing about this series. Because of the team that he's going to be driving for, he may actually get a podium finish based upon race strategy, which is not out of the question. But I hope it's a successful venture for him. I really do, because I think everyone benefits if it is. And I commend Chip for making this happen. There are corporate sponsors that they're bringing on board. The fact that he gets to share that ride with a legend like Tony Kanaan, I think, is huge for the series. And, you know, I welcome him for sure, because, you know, we just had a handful of dealings with him over the second half of the season when he was at the racetrack. And he is a sportsman and a gentleman. And I certainly wish him well, for sure.
Mark James of the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network joins us. We're going to take a quick break here on Inside Open Wheel. Coming up next, we go through Iowa to the rest of the season and go over some interesting moments, to say the least.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
With Mark James of the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network, wrapping up the 2020 NTT IndyCar Series season as it was. I'll tell you this, Mark, after the first four races, one has to wonder what the feeling was in Charlotte, North Carolina, behind the walls of Penske Racing, seeing how dominant the team from Indianapolis was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a healthy rivalry there between Roger and Chip. There's a mutual respect. I think they derive a great deal of joy out of the competition and the challenge of the competition between those teams. And certainly one is a little happier than the other when they have success, understandably so. I don't know. I you look up and down the roster of drivers, and you know, you take a look at who was on the grid at St. Petersburg. I mean, Newgarden, Dixon, Bourdais, Ryan Hunter-Reay, Pagano, Graham Rahal, Takuma Sato, two-time 500 winner, a rising star like Colton Herta, an up-and-comer like an Alex Palou. You know, there's Hinch and all the young guns like, you know, Renus VK and Pato Award and Connor Daly, and the list goes on and on and on. You know, Alexander Rossi, Scott McLaughlin, who came from another discipline. And I think that makes even more incredible what Scott Dixon did to start the season. And, you know, sometimes when drivers have a tendency to, quote-unquote, struggle – in the NTT IndyCar Series, Will Power has from time to time. Maybe Ryan Hunter-Reay has, or Graham Rahal. Well, gosh, what's wrong with them? If they lost their edge, you know, is there something wrong with the team? And, you know, that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes the pace is good, but Lady Luck has not smiled upon them for whatever the reason. But, you know, I prefer to think that this roster, like, for instance, the 24 that rolled off the grid at St. Petersburg, I mean, I would challenge any series anywhere in the world to put 24 cars on a grid out of however many run with them on a regular basis and find 24 drivers with the pedigree and the success and the reputation that the 24 drivers had at that race in particular. So that then speaks to, you know, be it 22 cars or maybe 25 or 26 cars. And then, oh, by the way, you get to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and you add, you know, a two-time Formula One champion to the mix like Fernando Alonso. I think right now at this point in time, I think the depth and the competitiveness of this field is as good as it has ever been. And I think challenges the depth that any other field and any other form of motorsports has to offer. And so because of that, makes Scott Dixon's feat to start the season even more impressive, which then leads to frustration and disappointment of having to play catch up with a guy like Scott Dixon to the rest of the field for the rest of the season.
And you know, I will say this. This has got to be the deepest field that I can remember in IndyCar racing. And I will be the first to admit, I did question when Ed Carpenter brought in Rinus VK. I felt that maybe he could have, you know, he had another season of Indy Lights to go out there. But hindsight's 2020. You know, it was a good move because outside of the snafu at Texas, I think Rinus did very well for how quickly he has come up through the road to Indy ladder.
Well, you know, this is not the first time that Ed Carpenter has brought a talented young driver along. You know, he's done that numerous times with his race team. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, once upon a time, if it weren't for Ed Carpenter, when Sarah Fisher's operation was shuttered, I mean, it was Ed that, you know, kept Joseph Newgarden in a ride, if memory serves me correctly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Ed was, as we've talked about on the air on our show, I mean, Ed was for sure not very complimentary of his young driver after Texas, but said that we're willing to be patient, and that patience paid off for sure. And, you know, I think he, you know, along with Askew and Pato, certainly, and Alex Palou, I mean, he's making their debut in the NTT IndyCar Series this year. I think Alex Palou is going to be really, really good for a really long time. And, you know, I know that Dale Coyne would have loved to have re-signed him, but you certainly understand why Alex made the decision that he made. And hopefully that opens up an opportunity for another talented young driver for Dale to introduce to the series and maybe build around the way he has over the past.
You know, and I would like to see a young driver come up through the ranks. That's obviously what Dale's been doing. Wouldn't be surprised if he hired a French driver or a Danish driver, though that Danish driver is going to be running in IMSA. Granted, they have Formula One experience, but nonetheless, it's going to be interesting to see who Dale brings up. We've heard, you know, obviously that Romain Grosjean, Kevin Magnussen, those names have been tossed around, but there's other drivers through other disciplines, you know, either in Europe or here in the States that Dale could easily bring in and groom for the next level of IndyCar racing. But I don't disagree with you. I think, you know, Alex Palou really showed a lot of promise out of the box, and I was really pleased to see how well he did so far this season, even if the paper doesn't tell the tale.
Yeah, I think, you know, all circumstances and how difficult this series can be for drivers to master. I don't think certainly Alex Palou has anything to hang his head about. And he was, like I said, a likable young driver for sure. I mean, he was an easy interview, a friendly interview, and always, you know, spoke his mind. And I think, you know, surprised a lot of people with how competitive that he was. You know, he finished 16th in points with Dale Coyne, and I think all in all put together a really solid campaign and shows that, you know, he has a certainly a bright future. I mean, he had a top five and three top tens. I mean, you know, he didn't lead a lot of laps, led one, I think, if memory serves me correctly, but seemed to be in contention more often than not and qualified really, really well.
Now, let's get back to the 2020 season. We led into that, and then as Mark and I usually do, kind of went off tangent, talked about a couple other things. Team Penske obviously shut out those first four races, but in Iowa, that seemed to be their playground. We know how well Joseph Newgarden does at Iowa Speedway, but I have to admit, it was refreshing to see Simon Pagenaud up near the front and take that first win.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, Simon's one of those guys that some, you know, people may be scratching their head a little bit, saying, "Hey, you know, what's the problem? What's Simon's issue?" I don't know that it's necessarily an issue. I mean, he finished eighth in points, and you know, this is a guy, you know, who's got, you know, a championship. He's got an Indy 500 win. you know, 13 poles, and I think, you know, before long he's going to start knocking on the door of 20 race wins in his career. And I think when you look at, you know, the season overall, with one win and the top fives and you know, almost double figure top tens, he led close to 100 laps. Uncharacteristic four DNFs for Simon Pagenaud, and I think that was the difference in him not being a championship contender. And I don't know that a lot of those things were necessarily of Simon's doing. So, you know, he's one of those guys that I think the year that he had would be a very good year for a lot of drivers, but it's not for Simon Pagenaud and Kyle Moyer and Ben Bretzman and that part of the organization. And I think they hold themselves to a higher standard than that. And so he's one of those guys that I think you can look at to hopefully have a strong rebound, if you will, in 2021.
And Joseph Newgarden taking race number two, taking us to the 104th running of the Indianapolis 500. By all accounts, you and I talked about it. Thought it was going to be the Marco, that Marco might actually be able to contend. We saw what happened on lap one. It ended up being Scott Dixon for 7/8 of the race, and then Takuma Sato ended up taking the lead on his own merit, not under own pit stops, and ran away with it. I've watched Takuma since he raced in Formula One, and it was great to see him in an IndyCar, but I'll tell you what, he's done quite well on the ovals, obviously winning twice at Indy and winning at Gateway last season.
Well, there was a pit window early on in the race that kind of put him in contention.
That's right, too,
and,
yes.
You know, the team took it from there. And, you know, yeah, I mean, when he first came to the series, he made a lot of enemies, and some would suggest that he still does from time to time. But bottom line is this. I mean, you don't back into two Indy 500 wins. And for whatever the reason, that place suits his driving style. And to win it, you know, with the two different race teams is pretty impressive as well, I think. And I always laughed and said, my gosh, anytime we interview the guy, just the sound of his voice makes you smile. I mean, I don't know how anyone doesn't like him, but you know, maybe they don't care for some of his moves, and sometimes maybe he's considered overly aggressive on the racetrack. For sure, that might draw the ire of some of his competitors. I think by and large he's liked in the paddock. I'd like to think he is. I know the fans love him. They really do, as is the case with most of our drivers. But I think that win was really impressive because, quite frankly, going into that race, I don't know that he was a part of the conversation, even though he's a former race winner. So I think, you know, pit strategy and I think once you understand how to win the 500, I think it does give you a bit of an advantage. And I think he did, you know, benefit from that, if you will. And as far as Marco, I mean, I don't think anybody was more disappointed than him than the events. And I really believed that he would, at the very least, find himself on the podium for the 500 after the month that he had. I mean, it was a trouble-free month, and he was competitive in every practice session near the top. That was an awesome qualifying run. And I remember that day that he ran for the pole. There was video of him out in the infield running to keep his mind sharp and keep himself in shape. And I just, you know, I saw a lot of things about Marco that indicated that maybe something was different and going to be different. I go all the way back to his duel with Sam Hornish. Mm-hmm. You know, where he lost it the last 100 yards, Kyle Moyer was his race strategist at the time. And I remember talking to Kyle at Phoenix and saying, is this rookie for real? He goes, yeah. He says he's going to win the Indy 500 because that place is best suited to his driving style. And, you know, he almost did. I still think I was in turn three at the time. And to this day, I still don't know how Sam caught back up to him after Marco ran him down in the grass in turn three and next to the last lap. But I think history shows, you know, how that ended up. And, you know, it was odd being there without fans for sure. I was hopeful, as odd as this may sound, that it would be a repeat winner, because the last thing I wanted was for someone to have to celebrate their first ever Indy 500 win with no fans there. Because it's not the Indy 500, really, truly, without fans. And I think the drivers agree with that. You know, there's no asterisk next to the name of Takuma Sato, nor should there ever be. He won that race fair and square, and he's a deserving champion for sure. And I'm glad that we had the opportunity to run the race. I just hope that we never, ever have to do it that way again.
Well, here's some food for thought, too, that I was thinking about as well. Takuma Sato, if you think about it, is three turns away from being a three-time winner as well. So this place is suited for him.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it was interesting when he first came here from Formula One. One of the tracks that he adapted to quickly and became one of his favorites was Iowa, of all places, which is unlike anything that he had ever seen in his entire career. But, I mean, statistically, he's got 6 race wins in his IndyCar Series career. And, oh, by the way, 2 of them happen to be the biggest race in the world in the Indianapolis 500. And that is a pretty impressive statistic. But, you know, he had, again, as we said, an awesome season. He had, you know, he led 172 laps and double figures almost in top tens and a couple of top fives and even won a pole. So I think, you know, one of the biggest beneficiaries, even though his results haven't, you know, necessarily translated into a lot of success for him. I know Graham Rahal bemoaned the fact that he never had a teammate to bounce things off of, and I think he's very, very happy to have someone with the experience of Sato to be able to share data and information with. And I think, you know, you talk about the quote-unquote big three all the time, and I think now, you know, Rahal, Letterman, Lanigan Racing's got to be considered in that conversation, and maybe the big three has become the big four, in fact.
And in the mid-2000s, you had Rahal, Letterman, Lanigan back. You know, it was Rahal, Letterman at the time in that conversation. I don't disagree. I think that, you know, keeping Takuma Sato on the team, having Graham Rahal, you know, been there for, man, I can't remember how long he's been there, but I think that, yeah, you can make them the big four. Next weekend was at Gateway as well, Dixon and Newgarden taking the wins. Oddly enough, that was Dixon's last win of the season, and that second race at Gateway, that's where we saw Newgarden start to chip away at that enormous points lead that Dixon built up at that point.
Well, I think, you know, while I think in terms of their personality, I wouldn't call Scott introverted, but I don't know that he's necessarily as quote-unquote gregarious as Joseph Newgarden is. However, I think they're very similar in their driving styles from the standpoint that, you know, if Joseph has a car underneath him that's capable of getting to the front, he's going to get to the front. If he's in a position where the door is open only slightly, he's going to kick it in and go on through and maybe make the kind of move that one doesn't expect him to make. And I think that was the difference in his championship win over Simon Pagenaud, you know, at Gateway of all places. I think if you go back to a late race pass that he made in the turn one on Simon, I think Simon's body language in the post-race celebration on the stage with the podium kind of indicated that Simon wasn't real happy with either Joseph or wasn't happy that move happened. But I think by and large, Joseph is, there's some similarities between he and Scott from the standpoint that when Joseph has a top 10 car, he knows how to bring home a top 10 car. And in the last quarter of the season, when he needed to push the button and force the issue, I mean, he didn't make it a foregone conclusion that Scott Dixon was going to win that championship. He made Scott a little uncomfortable, I think, down the stretch. And while certainly he's got a ways to go to start piling up the numbers that a guy like Scott Dixon has piled up, I think he's off to a really solid start in that regard. And I think the unfortunate position, if there is one, that Joseph finds himself in right now, is there is one glaring hole in his resume that took a guy, for instance, like Tony Kanaan, a long time to fill up. And that's, you know, getting a win at the Indianapolis 500. And I think while he celebrates his championships and he's proud of them and rightfully so, I would imagine that at least once today, if not more than that, the fact that he's yet to win the 500 probably seeps into the mind of Joseph Newgarden for a few minutes anyway.
Well, 5 races, 3 different tracks are coming up next. And we'll talk a little bit about what happens after the season next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, much like the final three weekends, we're into the home stretch of the 2020 NTT IndyCar Series season review with the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network's Mark Janes. Mid-Ohio, it's known as Scott Dixon's playground, really wasn't this time around. It's kind of odd to see him at the bottom of the top 10. An uncharacteristic spin from him. I can't remember if it was race one or race, I want to say race two, but Will Power and Colton Herta are really looking pretty good there at the track in the center of Ohio.
Yeah, I think that's clearly when Scott started to feel the pressure a little bit, I think. And, you know, the normally unmeltable Iceman didn't thaw, but certainly wavered a bit. And I think, you know, when we talked to Scott at St. Petersburg, I mean, nobody was harder on Scott Dixon than Scott Dixon about what happened at Mid-Ohio. He mentioned it several times throughout the course of the weekend and certainly in the post-race celebration. I mean, he took full account, full responsibility for what happened at Mid-Ohio, and you know, kind of felt like that he missed an opportunity to slam the door right then and there. And I think, again, that speaks to the greatness of Scott Dixon. I felt like that while Joseph was making it compelling and making it interesting, that's the first time I felt like, well, maybe Scott's changed a little bit, because I've always felt like that when he's got a championship in his grasp to that extent, that, you know, he can't, no one else can win it. He would have to lose it. And that's the first time I'd really thought in his career, when he'd been in that situation, that maybe that story was going to end differently than it had in the past. But I guess Scott Dixon showed me and others that thought that way, that we don't quite know as much as we think we do. He took on all challengers, including Joseph Newgarden, and was able to hoist the trophy over his head when we got ready to leave St. Petersburg.
And yeah, St. Petersburg, that's going to need another 5-10 minutes itself. Real quick though, Harvest Grand Prix. Rinus VK looking really good in practice, won the pole. Newgarden won race one. Will Power, we know how well he does there at the road course of Indianapolis, wins race number two. But it's great to see that Newgarden finally got the monkey off his back to win at IMS in an IndyCar.
Yeah, I think he's happy about that. You know, we talked about in our last segment, I think, the significance that he places moving forward on winning the 500. I mean, he's going to take more championships and going to do all he can to win as many races and as many titles as he can. That's why they do it. But certainly I expect to see him next May with the jaw locked a little tighter, especially when he – you know, he walks into Penske headquarters and, you know, you see Pagenaud's got one, you see Will's got one, and all the others that are there with Team Penske. I mean, he understands the heritage there and how much the 500 means to Roger. And, you know, he certainly wants to put his mark on Penske's legacy at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But now I tell you, we talked about it when we got off the air. The race that Will Power won. I mean, we certainly figured, because of the fact, you know, it's a few laps shorter, we certainly figured that that Will, it would be a battle for second place, quite frankly, because, you know, typically when Will Power starts up front, he stays up front. I don't think very often has he started on pole and ended up not winning a race. I don't have those hard, fast numbers in front of me, but I think they're pretty impressive. And I got the number of poles that Will Power has won. I mean, it is unlike anything I have ever seen. And, you know, while he's in a conversation with AJ and Mario and some of those guys for poles, I think, to put it in more perspective, I think he's done it in a relatively short amount of time. Because if you go back to when Elio had the legal troubles, if you remember, Will Power's future was uncertain at best. And Roger chose him to fill in for Elio until Elio could get, you know, those issues cleared up in court. And then once he did, Roger realized that he had something special, and special he has been. So, you know, there's a few guys that you would, you know, make more money off of betting on to win pole than Will Power. And again, when he does get pole, he usually ends up winning the race. And that's what makes him a heck of a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, that was a season. It was KVSH. Yeah, I think they let him go because he had the contract. If I remember correctly, that was Champ Car stuff. We'll worry about that later. But anyway, we go to St. Petersburg. And I've got to say this. That is the most action-packed race I have seen in IndyCar history since they were running at Chicagoland. Because, you know, first incident happened, then he turned around, then another, then another, then another. That middle part of the race had to be some of the most intriguing storylines that we saw all season long.
First of all, I was really happy for Green Savory and the fact that and the city of St. Petersburg because of, you know, the plug was pulled on the season opener for them, and their patience and their ability to work with Green Savory and IndyCar and the city to make the event happen. But I mean, you know, you look Will Power, you know, led the first handful of laps, and then, you know, Alexander Rossi took his turn at the point, James Hinchcliffe, then, you know, then Colton Herta, then Graham Rahal, then Herta again, Alex Palou led his lap. And then, you know, finally Joseph Newgarden was able to, take over the lead. And I think Joseph led 15, 16, maybe even 20 laps in getting a win. And, as you mentioned, if, you know, you stepped away for a few minutes, chances are that, you missed a lot, especially with six cautions in that race. And, nobody more disappointed than Alexander Rossi. I mean, this was a year where Alexander Rossi, I think the smart money based upon the last couple of years that he had had, there were a lot of people putting a lot of money on Alexander Rossi to win a championship, and it just didn't come together for him for whatever the reason. And, led 61 laps, and, his day ended on lap 70, and nobody was more indignant about that and more upset about it than Alexander Rossi. But, this sport can create the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And I'm sure Alexander Rossi, for one, was more than happy to see 2020 get put in the rearview mirror for a number of reasons, and is already chomping at the bit to get back at it in 2021. But give Joseph all the credit in the world. I mean, he did everything within his power to win that race and win that championship. And in the end, the gap between he and Scott Dixon was just too great. But again, Scott Dixon did what he always does. I mean, it wasn't the fastest car throughout the course of the weekend by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, he started 11th, and lo and behold, when the dust settled, he was able to get a podium finish out of finish third and secure the championship.
Real quick, I'm glad you're here because we have some developing news. Social media reports have been saying that the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach has been canceled. Nathan Brown of the Indianapolis Star tweeted out just moments ago, no decision has been made yet to either postpone or cancel the 2021 Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. The race's drop dead date for building the track isn't for another 8 weeks, so we won't expect a decision until January. I'm not even going to touch the 2021 season anytime soon, but real quick, what are your thoughts on, you know, really some of these states that we've seen have these capacity issues? Are we going to see more cancellations next year or postponements?
I don't think anybody has the answer to that. Okay. I really don't. I don't think when this all started in March and into April and May, I don't think any of us felt like that we would be approaching Christmas and still be dealing with it. And again, folks, I mean, there's no playbook for this. There's no blueprint. I mean, there's nothing in the past to go on. I think even some of the comparisons that I have seen, comparing it to the pandemic of 1918. I mean, what a vastly different country and world we all live mm-hmm. in. And I don't know. I play armchair quarterback like everybody else does when it comes to dealing with this, but I kind of keep those opinions to myself.
Yep.
And I think, you know, you just, we're constantly told live day by day. And I think at this point, we, guys like you and I, have to handle this day by day.
Yep.
And I know that based upon how we had to deal and were forced to deal with the pandemic, at least now moving forward, Penske Entertainment and Roger and Mark Miles and Jay Fry and all of these track promoters, at least now they do have the experience of 2020 to help them deal with 2021. So in that regard, you know, I have every reason to believe that there will be a season. Will it be as advertised? I think it's too early to tell, but do understand they were hopeful that all of these events would roll off as scheduled and on time, and that's why they scheduled them. But the thing that I do want to make clearer than any other point that I make, whether there are fans allowed at an event or not, whether an event is allowed to take place or not, those decisions aren't made by the track promoters. They're not made by the series themselves, regardless of the series. There are local, state, and federal governmental agencies that they are taking their directives from. And, you know, they have to fall in line with what they're being told and what the guidelines are. And to that point, I don't know that you can expect the rules for the state of California to be the same as the rules for the state of Alabama, mm-hmm. or for Alabama's rules to be the same as Florida's, or Florida's for Texas, or Texas to Indiana. That's another one of the many layers to this pandemic that has made it so difficult to navigate. So, you know, prepare to be disappointed, but hope for the best. And I guess that's all we can do at this point.
This is not knocking the Holman George family. What they did to the IRL and IndyCar to get us to this point to where we're at today, you have to give them thanks. You have to applaud them. But I can't think of any company better than the Penske Entertainment Corporation having control of IndyCar as it is. We know how well Roger Penske runs his businesses. The kids look like that they're doing well in their ventures as well. So I'm excited. Even though we are uncertain on what's going to happen, I feel extremely confident in the future of IndyCar, you know, not only next year, but 4 years to come.
I had a 30-year association with the Holman George family, and you know, a part of my broadcasting career when I did that full time was spent at their station in Terre Haute, and they are some of the most caring, most gracious people that I've ever had the opportunity to work for, and you know, they have done so much for motorsports, the motorsports community, but from a philanthropic standpoint, there's a lot of things that they have done for a lot of people, a lot of organizations, a lot of entities that they just quite frankly never wanted to draw attention to themselves for. And I can't thank them enough for my association with them. I mean, the quality of life that I enjoy in my family, I think, makes me deeply indebted to the Holman George family for many, many years. But to your point, I think the thing that made Roger well-suited to handle the difficulties of this pandemic was the fact that, I mean, he is a business and industrial leader on a global scale. I mean, it's a worldwide company. And so when you have the benefit of those resources, then I think that, you know, that certainly positions them well to be able to handle this situation on the fly. But I think, you know, in addition to Roger and Mark Miles and Jay Fry, the credit's got to be given to all of the track promoters that we work with throughout the course of the year. Us with the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network, our television partners at NBC. Let's not forget Dallara. Let's not forget Firestone. Let's not forget Chevrolet and Honda and all of the suppliers, some of those whose supply chains were disrupted by this pandemic and still had to produce parts and provide labor so the series could have a season. So, you know, no question, the leadership of Penske Entertainment, I think given how they were able to perform during a pandemic, keep our fingers crossed and pray that we get past this as soon as possible and get back to some semblance of normalcy. And I think once we achieve that goal, the sky will be the limit for the growth of the NTT IndyCar Series and the continued growth of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Well, Mark, I've got to say this. Thank you for joining me today and all throughout the season. We'll get you back on when the season gets going. But have a Merry Christmas, you and your family. Enjoy the time off. And, once we get more things together, let's definitely circle back, and we'll drag Nick back into the picture as well.
Well, Nick Yeoman, Jake Query, all of those guys, you know, I always give a farewell at the end of every season, at the end of the broadcast, and I get a bit emotional because those aren't just coworkers; those are some of my best friends. And, you know, you've been with us before, and you know the camaraderie that exists among all of us. And I can't thank you enough for your support and all you do to promote the great sport of racing. And any time that we have an opportunity to visit, certainly all you got to do is call me. I'm happy to do it. And health and happiness to you and yours, and hopefully we'll see you in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, hopefully we will. We've got some plans, but Mark James, the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network, thank you for joining us once again. Next week we have a big show. Some more IndyCar Radio friends are going to be joining us. Rob Howden and Steve Wittich will be on board. We're going to talk about the 2020 Road to Indy season. Also, I'm really excited for this interview. We just booked this. Coach Rod Reed, he is the owner of Force Indy. They are a new USF 2000 team that will be running next season. And it's a very special program that they have. I'm excited to learn more about it, and I know that you will be too. So, for Charlie Anti-Christian Rasmussen, of course, Mark James joining us here on Inside Open Wheel, thank you for joining us. Remember, we're now a group on Facebook, so make sure you find us, and we'll see you next week here on Inside Open Wheel. Take care, everybody.